Recently, that old traditional Chinese curse has been on my mind or been recurring. May you live in interesting times. Now, maybe that's not a real curse. Maybe it's a joke. I don't know. But it certainly seems relevant. And I have to say, at least speaking for myself, these are certainly the most interesting times of my life. And I'm not that young. I've been around for a while. This year, needless to say, almost all of us have been preoccupied with the coronavirus pandemic and the various fallout from that, including sort of economic problems. Sometimes I wonder if that could still get a lot worse. Different types of sort of social unrest and now political concerns as well. It's definitely been a very special kind of year, but we also need to remember that although necessarily we're focused on that, I think the backdrop that continues that's not getting better is the ecological crisis. And you'll notice that I don't refer just to the climate emergency, but the larger ecological crisis that the climate emergency is part of. I mean, we're pretty sure, for example, that the fires on the West Coast that have been the major news in the last week are aggravated by the increasingly hot and dry conditions due to climate change. And for that matter, we're also hearing a lot about the origins of the pandemic and the way that humans are encroaching upon the habitat of other animals, such as bats, which in this case seem to be the source of the virus. So it just reminds us, it brings us back, let's not completely overlook the fact that the larger context that we're faced with now is this ecological situation. I mean, this year, I think we've had a slight reduction in carbon emissions, but not enough to make a difference. And given the fires in Siberia and on the West Coast, I'm not sure it's better at all. But it still brings us back to this question that's often on my mind: what does the Buddhist tradition have to offer us that can help us understand and respond to this ecological crisis? I mean, we know we can't just turn to the Pali Canon or the Mahayana Sutras and just read off the answers, because our situation wasn't the type of situation that the Buddha faced or the other Buddhist traditions within Asia. Nonetheless, there are a lot of sort of implications or extrapolations that we can get if we sort of turn to Buddhist teachings and practices and just sort of ask, well, in what ways might they be relevant here? In an earlier talk, I already spoke about what I think is the most important implication, which is what I call the new Bodhisattva path or the Eco-Sattva path. I call it the new path, but basically it's not so different from what Buddhism has always taught. It's simply that it's new in the sense that we have, I think, a deeper appreciation of dukkha, suffering, and the institutional challenges that we have to respond to, as well as helping on the individual level. But anyway, what I'd like to talk about this evening is not maybe the most important issue, but nonetheless, it's the one that continues to be the most fascinating to me. And that's this extraordinary parallel that I see between what I think Buddhism has always taught about our individual situation, what our fundamental problem is, and how we might respond and resolve that. The relationship, the parallel between that and the kind of collective situation that we find ourselves in now in relationship to the earth or to the rest of the biosphere. In other words, if the fundamental issue is sense of separation, such as I'll be going into, can we understand that at the core of the ecological crisis is the sense of separation that we as a species, given the way that we've developed, feel also separate from the earth? So what I'd like to do is sort of present a talk in two parts. The first part, just giving you my potted summary of how we might articulate what Buddhism is talking about, what are, and again, this is my version of what I think Buddhism has always been emphasizing, and then going ahead and trying to show the parallels between that and the collective situation that we're in now. Parallels so striking, at least to me, that I'm tempted to say it's the same problem. The individual is the micro version, the collective is a macro version. And it also raises this interesting question: if the individual spiritual, if the individual path that Buddhism talks about is a spiritual path, and this parallel holds in the way that I think it does, can we also then, are we inspired or encouraged to understand the larger ecological crisis as also a kind of collective spiritual crisis? I'll leave that to you to decide for yourself at the end. Anyway, does that make sense so far? A talk in two parts. Part one, what does Buddhism have to say? And again, just going to hit the highlights as I understand it. For me, turning back to the roots of the tradition, it's pretty clear that the most important concept is dukkha. Dukkha is the word, of course, usually translated into English as suffering, but that only works if we understand it in the very broadest sense, not just physical and mental pain, but dissatisfaction, anxiety, dis-ease. The Buddha himself says in the Pali Canon that all he had to teach was dukkha and how to end it. And of course, the Four Noble Truths, which are the most well-known summary of his teachings, they're all about dukkha, the cause of dukkha, craving, the end of dukkha, nibbana, and finally the Eightfold Path that can lead to the end of dukkha. So it really seems like dukkha is very much at the heart of the issue. And if we go back to the earliest texts, they distinguish between different types of dukkha, right? As I said, physical, mental pain, also dukkha due to impermanence, the fact that everything, everyone we know and love is impermanent, is going to pass away, including ourselves, of course. Our own mortality is part of that. But it's there's a third type of dukkha that really stands out for me. And in fact, if I had to pick out the single most important teaching of the Buddha, the one that I would probably focus on is something like this: the connection between dukkha and the delusion of a separate self, right? This is that other really important teaching in Buddhism, very strange, the denial of a self. In contemporary terms, I think we can say something like this, that our usual sense of self, by which I mean the feeling, you know, the sense that we usually have, that there's a me somehow inside here, maybe behind the eyes, looking out at you and the rest of the world outside, that fundamental sense of separation is a delusion. And not just a delusion, but one that causes suffering, that there's an anxiety, that there's a dukkha connected with it, despite the fact that in order to function in daily life, you know, we need something like this sense of self normally. But nonetheless, there's a problem built in here. And I think we can understand it in this way, that if the sense of self is a construct, that is to say, if the sense of self is basically a result of the way that a lot of mostly habitual ways of thinking and feeling and acting, all these kind of processes, it's the way that these processes work together to create and sustain this sense of a separate self. The fundamental issue here is that, again, the self is kind of a function. It's not a thing. It doesn't have any reality. And here's the essential point. Because the sense of self doesn't have, because it doesn't reflect or refer to a real self that has self-existence, it means that this sense of self that we have is essentially insecure, basically uncomfortable. It's insecure because there's nothing there that could be secured. And especially in a place like the United States, it's like you can think the more individualistic a society is, and we're sort of at the top of that pyramid, the stronger the sense of separate self. And I think we could say the stronger the sense of discomfort that goes along with it. So I think for me, this is the first really essential point, that this sense of self is inherently uncomfortable. And I think we, in fact, we realize this. We experience it as a sense of lack, as the sense, the feeling that something is wrong with me, something is missing, something isn't quite right. I'm not good enough. And in fact, I think this is really one of the great sort of open secrets of life, that we all have this sense of lack to some degree, but we don't realize that everyone else does as well. Because when I look at you, you know, you seem quite real and substantial to me. But on the inside, this sense of discomfort or dis-ease is there. And where it becomes, the way we normally become aware of this sense of lack is we project it outward according to the kind of society we're in. It'll condition us. So like in the US, what do we lack? Well, we learn pretty quickly, you know, I don't have enough money, or I don't consume enough, or I'm not famous enough, or my partner isn't good enough, or whatever. But all of these can be understood as what I call lack projects, because the basic idea is that the fundamental problem with my life is that there's something out here I don't have enough of. But tragically, because these ways of understanding our sense of lack are just symptoms of the fundamental problem, what that implies is that in a way, although you might spend the whole meaning of your life trying to become as rich as you possibly can, you're never going to be able to get enough money or become famous enough or consume enough to fill up that void, that empty core at the heart of your being, as it were. That sense of lack cannot be resolved in this way. And this is quite tragic when you consider how in our society, in all kinds of ways, we are encouraged to look outside and try to resolve our problems in this way. It also encourages naturally a certain kind of self-preoccupation, right? It's like if I have the sense of lack and I have these lack projects are all about what can I get in order to feel better. Sometimes I call them reality projects, because another way to articulate this problem is that I don't feel real enough, but if I get enough of this, then it'll somehow make me feel real enough. And it's just really sad the way you can see so many people caught up playing these games that can't be won. The wonderful thing about the Buddhist path in these terms is that, of course, it shows us how we can actually resolve the problem. In particular, something like meditation, when we're focusing on our meditative theme, whatever that may be, we're sort of letting go of everything else that composes and constructs and supports our sense of self. It's like we're disidentifying from the usual aspects, from the things that we normally identify with. We let them go. And as Zen expresses it, then through this, there's the possibility of letting go of ourselves or letting go of our sense of self. So the great Japanese Zen master Dogen said, right, to study the Buddha Dharma is to study yourself. To study yourself is to forget yourself. To forget yourself is to realize your intimacy with all things. And experiencing our non-duality, our non-separation, right? And that allows a fundamental transformation too in terms of the meaning of our life or the focus, because insofar as we're caught up in lack projects, it's about how much of that can I get? Can I get enough of that for me? What's in it for me? Self-preoccupation. But once we really have a strong sense of how we're not separate from other people, then that allows this reorientation in the direction of what Buddhism calls bodhisattva, right? If I realize I'm not separate from you, that my well-being isn't separate from yours, then that can really make a huge difference in terms of what I focus on. And the idea of the bodhisattva path is more, you know, what can I do to make this a better world for all of us? Something like that. And it's a shift too, an important shift. And I'm going to mention this because it becomes relevant later. Whereas in the case of the lack projects, it's interesting how they're always future oriented, because they don't ever solve the problem, but they sort of promise, or we think they're going to solve the problem. So it means that we're always thinking. It's like, I have the sense of lack now, but when I have enough money or when I'm famous enough, then everything is going to be okay. So there's this constant negation or devaluation of being right here and right now. We're preoccupied with getting somewhere in the future, and we never are where we are, right? Now, that's the first part. Does that make any sense? I need a few nods here. That's my own way of articulating in a nutshell what I think kind of what our fundamental problem is and what Buddhism has to say about it and how we might, you know, resolve it. Now, what I think is really fascinating is that everything I've just said about our individual predicament also applies to our collective predicament right now in relationship to the earth. Because we not only have individual senses of self, we also have collective senses of self, right? So I'm not just David, but among the collective senses of self, I'm a man, not a woman, right? I'm American, I'm not Chinese. I'm white, I'm not black. And you can understand pretty quickly how these tie into all sorts of different types of tribalism. But the sense of self that I'm interested in here is sort of modern, our now global civilization as a whole. You can say humanity as a whole, but certainly those that are part of this now global civilization. The important point about self being is that self only has meaning in relationship to a not self, that which is not self, the other. And so we have this collective sense of ourselves as a species, as a now global civilization. What's the other? Well, it's the earth. It's the sense of duality from the earth that we feel separate from, in the sense that it's just there for us to use, right? We treat it as kind of a convenience store to extract whatever we want from it and to dump our waste into. But again, the sense of well-being, whereby we feel that somehow our well-being is the issue, and we can ignore questions about, well, what would it mean to promote the well-being of the earth as a whole? I mean, I think the ecological crisis is, to me, a fascinating example of karma, insofar as what we do to the earth, you know, sort of bounces back to us because we're not separate from the earth. And therefore, you know, if we damage the earth in certain ways, well, in a way, we're damaging ourselves because we're not separate from it. So the sense of separation from the earth, where does it come from? Again, I think it's not natural in the sense that it's something that developed historically. It wasn't always there is what I mean by that. I mean, if we look at our species, at least 95% of our history, I think it's actually 98% of our species history, we were hunter-gatherers, right? And if you're a hunter-gatherer, you've really got to be connected to the earth. If you're a hunter, you've got to know how your prey thinks, right? And you also better know how the predator that's looking for you thinks too. And in terms of if you're dependent on roots and berries and so forth, you need to know where they are and when, and you've got to be able to move around and so forth. So the whole point of that is, at that point, for our species, we are definitely embedded. We are part of the earth in a way that, frankly, today we can hardly conceive of. And it's interesting that archaeologists make the point, historians generally, that the greatest transformation in all of human history, of course, was the transformation to agriculture, which sort of enabled the possibility of civilization, right? Shifting from nomadic lifestyle, right? But it's interesting when you think about agriculture, okay, already with agriculture, you've got something to defend. There is an increasing sense of separation. You've got a fence, or you've got to have some way to keep the rest of the natural world outside. You don't want those animals eating your corn or your wheat. So you've created that separate sense. And also being in one place now, being stabilized, it creates another possibility, property. You know, hunting gatherers, you can't have much property. You got to carry it in your back. There's not much point. But once you're in one place, you've got property, and it also creates the fundamental problem that our species has never been able to resolve, which is classes, right? Because once you're in one place, especially once you have agriculture, you know, the good thing about agriculture is that it can provide a more dependable source of food for more people. It'll increase population. But then you've got this issue of surplus. Who controls the surplus? And then you get kings and priests and so forth, and you get the whole panoply of different classes of people and being controlled by the top. So there's the beginning here of this separation. But in a very, actually in two very important ways, this separation doesn't actually go very far. Because it's interesting that when you look at these early civilizations, I'm thinking of, say, Mesopotamia, Egypt, the pre-Columbian, Incas, Aztecs, Maya, that kind of thing. When you look at these really archaic civilizations, one of the interesting things is they still think of themselves as natural. It's like they're not aware that they're a construct. It's like they think that they're sort of inevitable. They tend to think of themselves as natural in the same way that they would take their ecosystems as natural. It's just the way things are. You can't challenge them. And one reason it's very hard to change anything is that they don't distinguish between sacred and secular order. It's like they're all mashed together. The guy at the top, it's usually a guy, the king or the emperor or the pharaoh, whatever. He's also the high priest or a god. And so they kind of mix it all together. They don't distinguish what's so important to us, the secular from the sacred. But here's the really most important point about these types of civilizations. And I'm spending so much time on this because I think it helps us understand the dukkha, the suffering, the dissatisfaction, or the anxiety built into the kind of civilization that we have now. All of these civilizations that I've been able to read about and study, they all believed that they had a really important role to play in keeping the cosmos working. And this is really interesting. It's hard for us to imagine, but they basically thought that they had a function. It wasn't simply that their civilization was on the earth. They had a role to play in keeping the earth working. So for example, Mesopotamians, they believed that humans had been created by the gods as their slaves, that we had this obligation to do sacrifices to feed them and to create these ziggurats, these temples to house them. And likewise, I'm sure most of us, maybe all of us, are familiar with this, maybe the most famous example of the Aztecs, who had this pretty gruesome habit of dragging their war captives up to the top of their step pyramids and cutting out their still beating hearts with obsidian knives and offering to them to the sun god. Why would they do something weird and horrible like that? Because they believed if you didn't do that, if you didn't feed the sun god in that way, he would lose his course. He would get lost and chaos would ensue. In other words, fascinating, all of these civilizations believed that they were necessary. Fascinating. And the reason I emphasize that is, although I don't think any of us would want to live in an Aztec or a Mesopotamian civilization, nonetheless, there was a kind of positive aspect that believing the structure of their society was part of the natural order, and that they had an important role to play in keeping the natural order harmonious, it conferred a kind of special psychological benefit that we don't have. They took for granted a collective sense of meaning that we don't have. In fact, we can hardly conceive of it today, because they understood their society as built into the cosmos. Their essential social role was also built into the cosmos. In other words, they knew why they were here and what they had to do. And the contrast I want to draw here is really strong, because today, the meaning of our individual lives and our societies as a whole is very different. It's something like we have to decide for ourselves in a universe whose meaning, if it has any at all, is something that we don't agree on. The result of this, and this is the big point I'm trying to make, is that we now have sort of increasing anxiety about who we are and what it means to be human. Loss of faith in the kind of life orientation that traditional religions normally provided, it's left us kind of rudderless. It's like we have these incredible, more powerful technologies that sort of enable us to do almost anything we want to do. But here's the question, what should we want to do? What's our role? Insofar as we can no longer depend on God or God-like rulers to tell us how to live, we're thrown back on ourselves. And this is the other side of the freedom, is the anxiety. The lack of our grounding in anything greater than ourselves has become a profound source of dukkha or anxiety. Let me say that again. Because we don't feel ourselves as grounded in anything greater than ourselves that we have some responsibility to, we feel, in one way, we're free, but the price of that freedom is a complete disorientation in terms of what's the meaning of our lives. I want to finish this section by reading to you the last couple sentences of a book that I'm sure some of you read by the Israeli academic Yuval Harari. He wrote this pretty famous book called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. And let me just read you the last few sentences, because I think it really summarizes here the kind of point that I'm trying to make, right? This is what he says. Despite the astonishing things that humans are capable of doing, we remain unsure of our goals and we seem to be as discontented as ever. We've advanced from canoes to steamships to space shuttles, but nobody knows where we are going. We're more powerful than ever before, but we have very little idea what to do with all that power. Worse still, humans seem more irresponsible than ever. Self-made gods, we are accountable to no one. Consequently, we're wreaking havoc on our fellow animals and on the surrounding ecosystems, seeking little more than our own comfort and amusement, yet never finding satisfaction. And then this is the last sentence of his book. Is there anything more dangerous than dissatisfied and irresponsible gods who don't know what they want? What do you think? Is that capturing something about our situation today? It's certainly elaborating on what I'm trying to point to. And the heart of the problem, I think, frankly, why we don't know why we want what we want, is that we no longer believe we have any role to play in the cosmos. Since we know that humans, like all other species that have evolved, were just accidents of genetic mutation, we're accountable to no one, accountable to nothing outside ourselves. So what does that mean? Well, all we can do is enjoy ourselves, if we can, while we can, as long as we can, until we die. Well, no wonder we feel dissatisfied and act irresponsibly, right? I hope this makes some sense here. Basically, what I've tried to do is show the first, what is it, 3 points of the comparison. We have this sense of separation, not only on the individual level, but collectively, we feel separate from the earth. It's a construct. It wasn't always the case. It evolved. Human civilization evolved that way. And the most important point, there's a dukkha, there's a dissatisfaction. There's a fundamental anxiety or dis-ease built into this sense of separation from the earth. That brings us to the fourth point. You remember I talked before, when I was talking on the individual level, I talked about these lack projects. I said, we have this fundamental dis-ease, this sense of lack, but we don't understand it. And so we tend to project it outside ourselves, right? What I lack is something out there. I don't have enough money, or I'm not famous, or whatever. And we become outward focused. And I'm wondering, do we have a collective version of this? And frankly, I think that we do. I think there's a comparable collective response. I think it's frankly our obsession with progress. Of course, built into the idea of progress is that somehow it's something good. But I think the problem is that as we often use the term, it's been hijacked to validate the consequences of never-ending economic growth and technological development. You know, the implication may be that, yeah, okay, well, with all this development and expansion, there might be some problems, but those problems can be resolved by more of the same. Nonetheless, yeah, I guess what I'm referring to here, that would be the heart of the progress I'm talking about, the belief in an ever-growing economic system, including the technological development that goes along with it. So the question I want to raise asking about that is, well, wait a minute here, hold on. When are we going to consume enough? When will corporate profits and share prices and our collective GNP be large enough? When will we have all the technology we need? Of course, these questions seem very odd because we know there's no limits to them. It's like we can go on forever and ever. But is there something odd about that? In other words, why is more and more always better if it can never be enough? It's one of my favorite lines, so I'll repeat it. Why is more and more always better if it can never be enough? I think the important point here is that economic growth, technological development, they can be really valuable as a means in order to accomplish something. But because we don't know where we want to go, what's important to achieve, what our role is, what's basically happened is we're so preoccupied with the means have become the ends, right? Ends in themselves. And frankly, they don't solve this fundamental problem. They're just kind of running away from the fundamental problem about what it means to be human and what is it we should be doing on this earth with all of these resources, right? The means have become the ends. They function as a kind of secular salvation that we seek but never quite attain. And so you could say, not knowing where to go, what to value, our civilization has become obsessed with ever increasing power and control. It's as if we're trying to sort of self-ground ourselves. And what we're discovering, certainly ecologically, but also psychologically, is that this cannot be achieved in a technological or economic way. I mean, I think there's a sense in which we as a civilization, we've become more anxious, more compulsive, not less. And I think it's simply we're haunted by this collective sense of lack. And this collective lack projects, economic growth, never-ending economic growth, technological development, these are destroying the biosphere. In fact, we can understand the ecological crisis is simply where these lack projects are bumping up against the limits of what it is that the biosphere, the Earth, is able to provide us. The Earth, basically the resources of the Earth don't grow, but our needs continue to grow. And sooner or later, that's a formula for the situation that we're starting to find ourselves in. So, I mean, I think that's a pretty big claim, but I think it's quite defensible that we not only have lack projects on the individual level, like I was talking about earlier, but we have this kind of collective global civilization lack project, more and more economic growth, more and more technological development. So, what's the solution? Is there a parallel with what we were saying before? I mean, we know on the individual level, Buddhism has a path, meditation, forgetting ourselves, letting go of ourselves, awakening. What would the comparable one be? If awakening is realizing our non-duality with the rest of the world, I'm thinking, for example, of somebody like Dogen, the great Japanese, 13th century Japanese Zen master Dogen, who's, after his own awakening, he said something like, I came to realize that mind is nothing other than rivers and mountains and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars, which is a pretty powerful way of articulating this idea of non-duality, non-separation, right? He realized he wasn't in here. In a way, he was all of this, right? We could see, maybe one way to say it, he realizes that he was one manifestation or expression of all of that. So what would the comparable thing be, if any, on the collective level? What do we need to do as a civilization? Do we need to return to nature? There's a really interesting parallel here too, with the idea that, you know, Buddhism basically says we can't get rid of the self. Why not? Because there never was a real separate self. What we can do is simply wake up to that, see through the delusion of a sense of self. And the same thing is true, of course, with returning to nature. We cannot return to nature. Why not? For the simple reason that we've never left it, right? What we call the environment is not a place where we just happen to be living. It's the ground from which and within which we arise. We're not in nature or on nature. We are nature. The earth isn't just our home. It's our mother. Before the earth is resources for us, it is the source. And in a very important sense, we don't really cut the umbilical cord when we think of our momentary, every moment interdependence, right? Remember what we learn in grade school about every time we breathe in the oxygen that plants produce, and then we breathe out the carbon dioxide that they need. So likewise, think about the water and the food. All of it makes us part of a greater holistic system that circulates through each of us. And certainly, our human bodies, we know they're made of the same elements that compose not only all the other animals, but the oceans, the rivers, the mountains, the trees. Why is our blood salty? Because it reproduces the salt water of the oceans. We share plus or minus 99% of our DNA with chimps and bonobos. In other words, our species has never been separate from the earth, but you could argue that we have been autistic. We have lost the awareness that we're part, and that so what we need to do is not return to the earth, but as it were, wake up. And of course, continuing the analogy, and maybe this is the most interesting part, what would a collective enlightenment be, right? It's like, again, on the individual level, the Buddhist solution is awakening, forgetting ourselves, realizing our non-separation. So what would a collective awakening be? What would a collective enlightenment be? I'm thinking of something Thich Nhat Hanh said. If we continue abusing the earth this way, there's no doubt that our civilization will be destroyed. This turnaround takes enlightenment, awakening. The Buddha attained individual awakening, but now we need a collective awakening to stop this course of destruction. Civilization, he says, is going to end if we continue to drown in this competition for power, fame, sex, and profit. So, but nonetheless, what does this mean? What does it mean to, what would a collective awakening mean? Does it mean that everyone has to become a Buddhist, or a large percentage, and everyone has to meditate hard and to realize, it's like, is it the case that a very large percentage of human beings have to awaken in the traditional Buddhist sense, in which case we might be waiting for a very long time? Or are we maybe perhaps overlooking something that might already be happening? And in a way, that's what I want to end on. Kind of a reflection on what collective enlightenment might actually involve. And here I want to take off from a book by a Zen practitioner named Paul Hawken. He's written a number of important books, but the one in particular that I want to refer to here is called Blessed Unrest: How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Happen, right? You know, Paul Hawken was, and as far as I know still is, right, he was kind of a lecturer that would go around the world and the country talking to people and corporations, how they can green themselves and so forth. And he would collect all these business cards and stick them in a drawer. And then one day he started to count them and do a little bit research online. And he came to a pretty amazing conclusion that right now is something is happening that's never happened before in human history, that there are a very large number of groups of people And the number he originally speculated was between 1 million and 1.5 million, although I think he now says over 2 million. He says, but there's a very large number of these organizations, most of them small, almost all nonprofit, that have sort of been springing up to work for social justice and ecological healing and sustainability, right? That these organizations have sort of sprung up in response to the kind of global challenges. Again, ecological for sure, but also social justice. He calls this the movement of movements and the fastest growing, he says. But most striking of all is the metaphor that Hawken uses to describe this movement. He calls it, and get this, this is the immune response of the earth. This movement of movements, these organizations, are the immune response of the earth, arising as if spontaneously to protect and to heal the planet from the forces that are despoiling it. He calls these organizations social antibodies attaching themselves to the pathologies of power. And he actually devotes a whole chapter to this analogy, where he says, quote, just as the immune system recognizes self and non-self, that this movement recognizes what's humane and not humane. Just as the immune system is the line of internal defense that allows an organism to persist over time, sustainability is a strategy for humanity to continue to exist over time. And then he makes the point, get this, the word immunity comes from the Latin immunis, which means literally ready to serve. Which makes me think of another name for these all these organizations. Can we understand them as group bodhisattvas? Can we understand this movement of movements as kind of the collective, how maybe our species might become the, how humanity might become a bodhisattva species? Notice that an immune system is part of something greater than itself. This is the important point, right? Remember what I was saying earlier about how these ancient civilizations, they felt they were part of something greater than ourselves. And a lot of our problem today is, I think we've lost that connection. We feel dissociated and we feel that there's no meaning except, you know, what's in it for us? Let's enjoy ourselves. The idea that we as a species might have a role, a responsibility to something greater than ourselves. What about the earth? As he says, white blood cells don't have a problem figuring out what their role is. The parallel seems too obvious. The ecosattva path too is about helping the earth to heal, a process that can also heal us. This may be a new way of understanding the Buddhist path, but it's not a new Buddhist path. In fact, Paul Hawken says, in terms of commitment, I think Buddhist practice is by its very nature social change. It cultivates compassion, which is the source of transformation. And so he sees Buddhism as one small part of this one part, growing part of this growing movement. He says, quote, Buddhism as an institution will become much more engaged in social issues because I can't see a future that doesn't, where conditions don't worsen for all of us. The gift of the years ahead is that we can't address the issues of our time and be the same people we are today. Dukkha suffering has always been the crucible of transformation for those who practice it. We could say our Buddhist path isn't about avoiding transformation, avoiding suffering, but being transformed by it, which frankly, I think it means there's a lot of transformation in our future. Joanna Macy points to the same sort of thing when she says, wherever I go to workshops, I find the readiness to experience a collective awakening. I'm astonished by how explicit this is. It's a sense of wanting to belong to the earth, aching for reverence for the earth. Again and again, I think people would be willing to die for the world to save the life process. There's something pressing within the heart mind that's just huge, and it's happening very, very fast. So this is the sort of conclusion. Is this the kind of collective enlightenment that Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about? Not something we see within just in the Buddhist world, but something is happening to our species. Is this collective immune response? Is something like Extinction Rebellion or 350.org or Black Lives Matter? Can we understand these organizations as part of this immune response where it's not just individuals waking up, but as it were, there's a kind of social awakening happening? As a small part of this worldwide movement, Buddhism might have a distinctive role to play, because when I talk about the Ecosattva path, I think the most important thing Buddhism has to offer is the emphasis on the double-sidedness, that it's not enough to work for social change. We also have to continue to work for our own individual transformation, that the two need each other, right? Might humanity become the bodhisattva species, as I said, working for the well-being of the whole biosphere? Does that maybe offer us a possible answer to this great question? Also, on the collective level, what is the meaning of life for us? Do we as a species have a role to play? Maybe a necessary role to play if we are going to survive. Do we need to realize that we have to open up, and in out of realizing our interdependence and our groundedness with all the other species of the earth, does that also provide the answer we need to this fundamental question about what's the meaning of our species? What is it all about? Why are we here? Is it simply that are we here to love and to cherish and to take care of the earth, which takes care of all of us? So maybe I'll stop there. Thank you.